Obama continues to hemorrhage his failed ideas out upon the once trusting American populace and betray his great land, this great land, with more inane socialism and anthropogenic, whatever it's called, global warming. Now he demands we not drill in the Arctic. Of course, most Americans want cheaper fuel and energy independence. Further, we rate global warming as the least important issue in poll after poll, despite the fact that the easily misled or highly deceptive Barack, take your choice, says it's a greater threat than ISIS or radical Islam. We'll go tell that to the people in the German market who got run over by that 18-wheeler. Further evidence of why Americans preferred Trump. Catholics chose him, according to Mr. Buckley, and he explains why. First off, the church is Catholic in the small c sense, meaning universal and composed of just about every ethnic group. James Joyce saw this and thought the church's motto should be, here comes everybody. That was Trump's motto, too. Indeed, it was the Democrats who practiced the politics of division. In private comments, leading Democrats ridiculed Catholics. In an exchange with Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, President Obama's Solicitor General suggested Catholic and religious colleges that are faithful to their beliefs might lose federal funds. Hillary Clinton herself said in a very scary and diabolical statement, our legal system must reform, quote, deep-seated cultural codes, religious beliefs, and structural biases to ensure ready access to abortion. As we discussed before, that's Caesaropapism, the idea that the government decides what's true as opposed to religion or how people should live or what they should spend their lives doing. Then when the choice was put to the Democratic presidential candidates, they all picked Black Lives Matter over All Lives Matter, with the exception of Jim Webb, who was out very quickly. Second, like Trump supporters, Catholics are patriotic and strongly attracted to the call to, quote, make America great again. Think they need to apologize to anyone for their country, and they don't like what's happened to American history as it's taught in our schools and universities these days. Third, lay Catholics, at least the non-intellectuals, aren't the prisoners of political ideology the left are. They're looking for policies that speak to the concerns of ordinary Americans, things that work, not abstract theories. So anyway, there you go. If you're a Catholic and you supported Trump, well, according to the polls, that occurred by 7 percentage points, although Obama had won before, I think, by 2 percentage points, which is kind of interesting because Catholics are, by definition, opposed to abortion. And the one thing that Obama expressed the most enthusiasm for was abortion, which should tell you everything you need to know about the guy. But Catholics are open to Trump, at least the majority of them, and they are, or I should say you are, cautiously optimistic like the rest of us to see what's going to happen. But so far it's promising, and Trump's numbers are up quite a bit. So, all right, I've got a lot of stuff here today. But let me hit you with some headlines on this 21st day. You got 4 days to go buy overpriced gifts. Of course, you could do Christmas the day after and save 90% of the cost. But Berlin manhunt as killer escapes Europe on Christmas alert. And now they're, if you're listening to the news, they are claiming that the guy was, where was he? I think from Africa, somewhere in Africa, as opposed to the Middle East. Refugee resettlement accelerates in Obama's final months. Admissions of Syrian Somalis and ahead of last year's pace. Now, Angela Merkel has totally screwed up Germany, and people in Germany, which are not typically, the culture is a little bit, keep your opinion to yourself, but there's a lot of Germans that are very upset with her. And let me tell you something, when you're trying to go around and pretend that you're a world citizen, a world-class citizen, there's no upside to doing politically correct things. You get all the bang from your buck while announcing it to people. Other than that, it's a total disaster. So Angela Merkel has failed the German people just like our dear Barack has failed us. And we got a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, Kelly, it's Tom.
Good morning, Tom. Hope you're well. And what's on your mind?
Well, last night at about 11:30, I was driving up Highway 70 and on the south side over by Holman, I believe it was, so the exit, watched the trailer burning to the ground again.
Wow.
Yeah. I just want to warn people, be real careful around Christmas time with your lights or your heaters and stuff like that. I don't know how this fire occurred, but it was a devastating fire.
Yeah, what a time of year to lose everything, you know?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Take care, Kelly.
You too. Bye-bye. Wow, it's terrible. Hopefully the neighbors will be able to kick in. All right, so looking for this. All right, as a matter of fact, I've got a clip on this that I'll play for you in just a second. On people's opinions of Merkel. Here's the problem, folks. You've got a belief system that is characterized by just a few things. As I had stated the other day, I suddenly had this insight that liberalism, far leftism, not the kind of liberalism that the listeners of this show buy into, which tends to be gentle in comparison. Liberalism is an attitude. It is not an education. So a person, contradictorily, people who become liberal, or I guess who grow up liberal, have the sense within themselves that they're smarter than everybody else and better educated, which is just simply not true. I mean, it's because education comes through effort. You don't adopt a political, posture and then suddenly get the Encyclopedia Britannica poured into your ear. But one of the other characteristics, other than megalomania or the sense that you're one of the truly smart people in history, I guess, which would come with it. Another thing that goes along with that is talking down to people. So, I mean, that's one of the ways that you can sniff out liberals, true liberals, far lefties, progressives, Marxists, socialists, fill in the blank there. So Angela Merkel gets up, never, you know, is very, very kind of calm and dour and kind of like Obama, has got this, they put on this posture, the posture of a person who knows everything, and then they start decision making and, you know, total collapse. So these people have to be resisted. I'm talking about people with far left ideology because it's total destruction in their wake, you know. Anyway, here's Bolton on Fox talking about Germans think they've lost control of their country. Merkel has opened country to terrorism. That's undeniably true. If they hadn't let out this million plus Muslims in, they wouldn't be looking at, you know, trucks running over their people every few weeks and shootings and knifings and stabbings and axings and all these other things, in which the people who are coming in reveal for the host country their enthusiasm and their gratitude by trying to kill them.
An Enterprise Institute and a Fox News contributor. Sir, welcome and good morning to you.
Good morning.
20 minutes ago, we saw the German leader, Angela Merkel, visit the site there in Berlin. Explain to us the challenge she now faces after committing to a million refugees some 14 months ago out of Syria, at a time where there's some confusion as to who is responsible ultimately for this. We thought there was a Pakistani in custody seeking asylum. Perhaps he is responsible, but some officials in Berlin suggesting they've got the wrong guy. Let's see how this story plays out and where it leads. But having said that, what is her challenge now, do you believe, sir?
Well, with that caveat, look, she faces elections next year. Her policy on this mass admission of people seeking asylum in Germany was terribly controversial before. This is going to, I think, compound her political problems significantly in a way we've seen reverberating all over Europe. So how this plays out, what the final arrest situation is, I think is going to be very significant. And God forbid, we still have several days to go before Christmas, whether there are going to be more attacks like this, whether in Germany, elsewhere. Or in Europe or the United States.
Clearly, you're aware that many in Germany believe that she has blood on her hands. Politically, how does she deal with that? Policy-wise, how does she react to that?
Well, she's already tried to take some steps inside Germany by calling on bands of women wearing burqas and the like to try and go after the most visible manifestation of the rise of Islamism in Germany. But I think the feeling that many Germans have had and are reluctant to say out loud, given Germany's own history, is that they feel that they've lost control of their country. It's not a feeling that's unknown elsewhere in Europe. But Merkel has been the biggest symbol, I think, across the continent of somebody who was open to this policy. It's aroused a lot of resentment outside of Germany. Viktor Orban, controversial president of Hungary, said, we don't plan to pay for Germany's mistake. And I think the question is whether enough Germans believe it was Angela Merkel's mistake that she loses next year and is no longer chancellor.
You say she's the biggest symbol in Europe.
Right. Look, she, by her unilateral action in allowing this wave of refugees to come into Europe, she definitely exposed Germany and others to the risk of terrorism. I remember vividly at the time she made that announcement, a member of the Lebanese cabinet estimated that something like 2% of all the refugees admitted would be terrorists. Now, she officially admitted 800,000. Do the math. That's 16,000 terrorists.
2% of 800,000. You're exactly right.
And many more than 800,000 came in.
I want to move to Russia right now. You've got the Russian ambassador murdered in cold blood in the country of Turkey. Vladimir Putin, already strong comments, and you know his history. Putin talks tough when it happens.
Well, they're going to go and start killing people that they think are involved with that that murder. But don't forget that Obama walked away from this special relationship with England, and then he tied his wagon to Angela Merkel because they have the same basic outlook. You know, put aside his attitude, his obvious self-love, his extraordinary enthusiasm and euphoria for himself. And what did he achieve? What exactly is it that Obama achieved? Supposedly his great achievement was Obamacare, and now we're on the verge. The buzzards are circling. Obamacare is dead. They're about to pick all the flesh off the carcass and try to rebuild it. If that is the best that he could do, his best achievement, he has totally failed. And I don't think there's any way to cover that up. Well, it's 6:20 a.m. Las Cruces AM 1450. Kelly O'Connell on KOBE and 523-1450 to call in. Get your calls in here. And we're putting on a little bit of Christmas music. I've got a clip for you later. 300... I think it's called 300 Prophecies That Jesus Fulfilled. I thought you might find that interesting. We'll be right back. So might as well give Obama a few more kicks on his way out the pet door before Trump comes in. But, you know, Illinois is like the most failed state. And the reason that I say that is they're losing more population than any other state, according to the Chicago Tribune. And the reason for this include high taxes, state budget stalemate, crime, unemployment, and weather. Census data release last year suggested the root of the problem was the Chicago area. You've got a place with so many murders in it. And so let me ask you this. Obama was a state senator, and then he was a United States senator, and then he was the president of the United States. How much did he put into making Illinois and Chicago a better place? I mean, I what I'd like to know is, where's this guy's leadership? If Obama was the greatest leader of his era, of his age, one of the greatest speakers of all time, where's the fruit of his genius? And I mean, seriously, where exactly is this? So, you know, you look around and you look for the genius of Obama, and at one time, I think he believed that giving a speech was the key to, he had this kind of strange idea. He'd get up and give a speech and an army of persons would spontaneously erupt. I'm not kidding that this is what he had communicated to people. He would give speeches and people would spontaneously like form a robot army to go out and do what he was talking about. And now 8 years later, let me ask you this. Does Obama have any regrets? If you're a megalomaniac or if you're a sociopath or whatever the description of Obama is, maybe it's just a narcissist. If you are of that group of people, do you ever publicly apologize? No, because the president really has never apologized for any of the mistakes he's made. But do you inside ever regret the chances that were lost? Because if you recall, when Obama came in, there was such extraordinary acclaim for him, and he had the power of being the new guy on the new kid in town. He also had the power that people were willing to suspend their disbelief in a Democrat because he was supposed to be a new kind of a person, you know, new kind of a politician, a post-political figure, post-racial. Remember that? He's going to cut the deficit in half. He was going to do so many different things, and he didn't... Was it that he didn't have it in his capability to lead all people, or was it he just didn't, he was a stubborn person who really thought he was on the right side of history? He said this many times in a row, many times in succession, that the Democrats, the liberals are on the right side of history. If they fall by the wayside, if they crumble and disappear, blow away in the wind, are they still on the right side of history? Here is a little bit on Chicago's murder rate hitting a deadly milestone in November 1st, 2016, Wall Street Journal.
City of Chicago 2016 had already been a deadly year, but this weekend, Chicago's spiraling violence passed a grim new milestone. More than 600 murders so far this year, up 45% from the same period a year ago, a level that hasn't been seen in more than a decade. The Wall Street Journal's Shabani Matani reports that 18 people were murdered from Friday through Sunday, bringing total homicides this year to 614. The last time annual murders topped 600 in the city was 2003. The murders have far outstripped the totals in some other large cities this year, with more homicides than in New York and Los Angeles combined, despite Chicago's much smaller population. Along with cities such as Baltimore and Houston, Chicago is driving a surge in the national murder rate, which is projected to rise 31.5% this year from 2014. Back in 2003, Chicago topped the nation's homicide rate, despite a steep drop from the year before. But there are fewer officers in the city today than in 2003, about 12,500 versus more than 13,500 then. And relatively strong community involvement also helped police solve 51% of the murders that year. This year's murder spree appears random by contrast. There's been little help from the community to explain why most of these people were killed, and only 21% of the murders have been solved so far. Mayor Rahm Emanuel acknowledged in a September speech the, quote, hopeful trend, unquote, of declining violent crime since the 90s, when more than 900 people were murdered annually. Chicago police say the department is undergoing reforms to restore public trust, including changes to their use of force policy and increased transparency for police officer-involved shootings. The city plans to hire almost 1,000 new officers in coming months.
So Rahm Emanuel was involved in a very, very extraordinary cover-up of a murder by a cop of a young black man who was running away and was no threat. And the guy pulled out his gun and started shooting. And as I recall, he started laughing as well. I can't remember all the details, but and this is the Mr. Don't let any crisis go to waste. Now, they gave this kid's family $5 million to keep it hush-hush before the election. So, anyway, I didn't even really mean to go into that, except that I wanted to point out to you that the president had an extraordinary opportunity, and what has he made of it? Now, if you're a Frankie, and Frankie, I do apologize for hanging up on you yesterday, except you started ranting and raving and are not listening. So, if you call into the show, I think most people understand by now, call in, make your point, take a breath so I can respond, or you can hear what's going on, and we'll take it from there. this is not public access TV. So what did Obama make of his opportunity? I mean, is it not a disaster? 8 straight years of sub 2% growth. Is that not a disaster? If he's a liberal or a Democrat, does that somehow make that okay? That's the message that I keep getting from these people is if the Republicans were in there and there was no growth, it would be a disaster on them. If it's the liberals, they're fighting against global warming. They're fighting against the evils of capitalism. You can't have it both ways, you know? It's either a disaster or it's not. We have a phone call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
It's Ralph.
Good morning, Ralph. Are you ready to read your Lincoln?
No. I want that to just stop right now. And
all right.
Later on.
Okay.
Obama.
Okay.
Wants to bring it. Okay. This is a subject you haven't brought up in quite a while, Kelly, and maybe if it's out of line, cut me off right away. No bad language or anything like that. I have a very close friend that's a veteran. He joined the 82nd Airborne when he was 17. He's in some of the worst combats in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's in a slammer right now. He tried to take his life twice. The first time he almost succeeded. Second time he landed at Mountain View. Anyway, he had a citation to appear in court on October the 23rd.
Okay.
When I found out he was in intensive care, I got a ride and I went over there. He was in a coma. October the 23rd, about 3:11 in the afternoon.
Okay.
On the following day, he had an appearance in court. He didn't make it. You won't believe this, Callie. I talked to him the day before he was going to go to El Paso for rehab. They finally convinced him to go to rehab instead of killing himself. That day, he was arrested for failure to appear. That was before Thanksgiving, 1 or 2 days before Thanksgiving, Kelly. And you know what? He's still in jail. I have talked to the detention center. That's how I found out what all it was about. Nobody seems to give a rat's rear end. you for that.
Well, if I could make a suggestion that you call up the district attorney's office, because they claim to care deeply about veterans, and just see if you can find somebody, find his attorney, find the prosecutor, and ask him if you can talk to him and point out to him that this is, if what you're saying is true, it's just a complete miscarriage of justice. He's not in any shape to be in jail or prison right now anyway. And maybe the DA can advocate. Although I've found that contacting the DA's office and trying to get a hold of the people that run it and give them information on things that are going wrong is a complete hoax. So, you know.
Kelly, I did try. I called four times. I was giving a number to the gentleman that is in, more or less in charge of this project that the Antonio and the Attorney General have going on.
Yeah.
You know, he mentioned that on one of your...
Yeah, I remember.
He did. So, four times. And the detention center, I've called four times. The judge that signed the order...
Who was it?
That had him incarcerated. I've called them more than four times.
Who was the judge?
Driggers?
Well, I mean, before anybody blames Driggers, he's got people coming in front of him giving him information. He does, you know, the judge doesn't have an ability to independent ability to go fact find. I mean, he's just running a court. But this happened. Then the DA's office was informed, or should have been informed, of what was going on. I don't know all the parts of this, but I can guarantee you that trying to get a hold of the leadership at the DA's office and getting them to come in on problems is just, I'm not even going to try anymore.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. But anyway, I didn't stop there. I called the VA to see if they could intervene or do something about it. Would you believe that it is about it? Well, it is about as worthless as you can possibly imagine. The fact that they left a veteran dead in the shower for over 9 hours tells it about all.
Yeah.
But anyway, I have been trying and trying to no avail. I realize that a lot of people cannot help, but their attitude, their tone of voice, Kelly, you're not aware of this, but I've had some training on voice analysis, facial expression, body language. I can tell exactly... Even if you turn your face when you're talking on that phone or on the mic, if you turn your head, I can tell that you've turned it. Anyway, the tone of voice that these people use, they just flat don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look.
And I can't get anybody to help.
All right.
I shouldn't have brought this up.
It's all right. It's all right.
It's not in your topics, but anyway, I am so
Ralph,
disappointed. Right?
Ralph.
The holidays,
Ralph. Ralph,
no
listen. Ralph, hold on a second, because we're burning up the hours here. Do me a favor, call my office when you get off. Just look me up in the phone book and call my office. We'll see if we can intervene on this. But there's something very bad going on at the DA's office. And remember, folks, when a fish goes bad, it starts at the head. It starts at the head.
Try to call your office.
Okay, but I got to go. Ralph, I've got to go. Thank you. All right, folks. I can't spend, no matter what the issue is, I can't spend 10 minutes on it. We'll be right back. 638, 639, Kelly O'Connell, AM, Massachusetts, AM 1450, 523, 1450. There are, by the way, very good people working at the DA's office, some of which I'm friends with. I apologize for the long break, but we had gone without a break for a while. So, listen, if you are someone who's a veteran who's having problem in the justice system, or if you know somebody, give my number, my work number, my law firm, 805 805-1245, 805-1245. I will try to help you if I can. I'll try to find somebody else that can. But, I mean, what Ralph was talking about is an absolute travesty. I mean, our veterans should not be treated that way. Of course, I don't know all the details, but I do know that it is a very difficult working with the DA's office at the highest level. So I don't know anything about the program that was put together that was mentioned on the show, but I will do what I can to help you. And all I can say is don't put your faith in the DA. Now, having said that, all right, so here is this ban. Now, Obama being a basically a passive aggressive personality, a teenager at heart, wants to leave office, you know, and do as many destructive things as he can on the way out. He bans new oil and gas drilling in the U.S. Arctic and Atlantic waters. You know, what if there's trillions of barrels of gas and oil out there? Does he care? No, because he stands for the proposition that here is the simplistic mindset of the same guy that stood up and said you can't drill your way out is now making sure we can't drill our way out by blocking any exploration or development. Here you go, Euronews.
Drilling for oil and gas has been banned in U.S. waters in the Atlantic and Arctic oceans by Barack Obama. The move is being seen as an attempt by the outgoing president to leave his mark in protecting the environment before Donald Trump takes office, even though few energy companies have sought to drill anytime soon in those areas. Exploratory drilling in the Arctic is expensive and risky. Canada has also announced similar plans for its own Arctic waters. Obama used the 1950s law that allows presidents to limit areas from mineral leasing and drilling. He cited studies saying the risks of an oil spill in the region are significant and the ability to deal with one limited. The incoming president-elect has said he's in favor of expanding offshore oil and gas drilling, promising to take advantage of existing U.S. reserves. But environmental groups say Trump would have to go to court to overturn the permanent nature of the ban.
Where's the wall? We want the wall.
All right. And here he's got some, of course, you know, look at it from Obama's point of view. At this point, there's been so many disasters, so many mistakes that he either is a messiah of the first rank and is looking so far into the future that although his decisions now may seem stupid and ill-advised, in the future generations will get down and worship him like Alexander the Great, like George Washington. Unless he has that to fall back on, I don't see what the other argument is, that he's a great man, that he's a great leader. Here's from AP, Associated Press.
On Wednesday, the president will host two Hanukkah receptions here at the White House.
Mark, as you point out, this was something released, I believe, a short while ago, announced in Alaska, and it's in response to requests we've gotten from indigenous people up there that the coastal tribes along the northern Bering Sea and the Bering Strait requested that the federal government take this action to protect the health of marine ecosystems of the northern Bering Sea, while maintaining opportunities for sustainable fishing and sustainable economic development. So this was the right decision to make. If you have more questions about it, we can get you the details.
The details. We're going to block off. That's what this guy does. He comes in and goes into the Oregon Mountains and takes away our access to land and then expects to be, put on the, speaking of mountains, to be put on the, what do you call it? Mount Rushmore. Remember the minister that wanted to do that? Man, he said he got a lot of people that were very furious at him. That guy went to Israel and to open a Bible school, and then he came back and he said, whatever, when he came back on the show, he said, whatever you do, please don't bring that up. All right, let's, we'll take another break here. And I've got a little weather for you when we come back. National weather affecting New Mexico. All right, here's a little weather for you. From it looks like there could be some snow. Right here, check it out. But not up here. There's not going to be snow here. Yeah, hold on a second here. Well, I don't see that. Oh, okay. Hold on a second here. Check it out.
Take a look at Reed Point, Montana there. Looks pretty nasty, huh, with the wind, the snow, blowing snow. Well, we have the opportunity for more of that coming into the picture with a Christmas storm that is actually going to bring a triple threat. So we're talking snow with this. We have ice in the picture with this, and also the element of severe weather. Now, this storm gets going on Friday to the west. It moves off to the east through Christmas weekend. So we're talking Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. There you go. Heavy snow from the Dakotas down through the Rockies. But look at the ice that develops through the Midwest, and then rain on the southern edge could have some severe weather with that. Now, as this storm pulls off to the east, there's a lot of mild air over the country, so the rain snow line stays well to the north as this storm pushes through the Ohio Valley and into the Northeast, wrapping up by Tuesday. As far as the snowfall forecast goes, the heaviest snow is going to be out through the west. Parts of the Dakotas, you could get up to a foot.
All right, so now we've got just enough time to do our semi-regular Beck Watch. Beck has now joined forces with this lady named Samantha Bee, who is just an awful would-be comedian. Check this out. This is from Alex Jones. I honestly can't believe how much damage Beck has done to his career.
On top of Michael Moore, Alex, you'll like this. Glenn Beck is trending at the top of Twitter right now because he's announced an alliance with the far-left Samantha Bee Comedy Central woman to fight Trumpism. So this is the guy, Alex, who is notorious, has made a speciality out of stabbing authentic grassroots political movements in the back.
I told people 6 years ago he was a Trojan horse, an actor, a globalist Democratic operative, because I had it from inside people. Now it's completely proven. He is the Judas Iscariot, the Benedict Arnold. He goes on the news and says, conservatives are fake. We're frauds. It's all a scam. But they have these real fake news channels go on NPR and speak for me and go, here's how Alex does it. So that's all he's got now, is going on these shows and groveling and begging for mainstream shows. I mean, this guy is worse than I ever thought. That's
exactly what it is. He was sat there with her groveling, eating cake, and talking about how much they have in common.
Well, he knew they were going to install Hillary. He thought that for sure. He thought he bet on the good horse. He knew net censorship was coming. Drudge was told this too, but came and warned people here. He was told that they were going to censor. He decided to roll over. He was told they were going to shut down the independent press. He was told they were coming after the alt-right. He was told Facebook was going to do this. So he went and met on his belly like a snake, crawling to Zuckerberg. Remember that? And so he's chosen to join with Soros.
Yeah, because he stabs authentic grassroots political movements in the back. That's what he does. He did it in 2007, implied that Ron Paul supporters were domestic terrorists. In 2012, when Ron Paul ran again, he compared Ron Paul to Osama bin Laden. This is a guy who stabs authentic grassroots political movements in the back. Now, Ron Paul was a lot less on a lower scale than Trump, but same rule applies, an authentic grassroots.
We know that Glenn Beck is literally the biggest scumbag in America. Because at least Moore with his six bodyguards that says we can't have guns, you know, is open about his hate of this country. When you're dealing with somebody like Beck, you are dealing with the ultimate phony, the ultimate psychopath. That's why he always acts nice and sweet and cute, because they don't know how to act like that, so they put on this, you know, fake deal like, look, I've got a puppy, I've got candy. I mean, he is the creepiest guy in those sweaters he wears to all look kind of wimpy on purpose. I mean, this guy is a predator. Paul, I'm handing the baton to you. We salute you.
All right. So anyway, to be honest, I don't know what Glenn Beck's goal was. When he got out of Fox News, his plan, according to those on the inside, it was actually stated in his materials, was to be the next Walt Disney. He was going to use his brand, his fame. He opened two studios, one of which I don't even know if they ever used. They got one in New York City for $2 million a year that I think Yahoo had previously had, and they had to break the lease on that. But he's just destroyed his brand. Now, I'm sure there's still a lot of people out there who enjoy listening to him, but and he is, without a doubt, in my opinion, the most talented broadcaster. He is, like Alex Jones just said, he's an actor. He can emote. He can bring up anything. He's just got great timing. He's funny. He can cry at the drop of a hat, all this stuff. But I don't know what he used to believe, but what from watching him now, it seems like he is a leftist. I mean, what else is there? What other description is there? 659 Kelly O'Connell. We're going to come back. I'm going to throw at you a few things that I think you'll enjoy. And after a break on the air, 523-1450 on KOBE. So we were talking last hour about some of the mistakes that the president had made on his way out of office. And you might say, well, what difference does it make now? He's yesterday's news. But I mean, he's still doing stuff that is harmful to America. That is his, you know, that's his hallmark. What beef that he has with America, I mean, you can figure out pretty easily between his father is father's problems in, you know, his mother was a socialist. His grandparents were socialist Marxists who are, you know, is if you grow up against or around, leftism, the main characteristic of leftism is discontent. And so it's a very unhappy, shrill, view of life. And everything is therefore has a problem in it that only leftism, only socialism can answer. And then you apply socialism and the problems get 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times worse. But as we've seen, you know, the only thing that socialism is good at is propaganda. So I was talking about that, and then Ralph calls up and says he's got a friend who was in the hospital when his trial date came up or his hearing date came up and was not able to make the hearing. I don't know anything about this. I don't know if the details are correct, but that's what he stated. He was a veteran. He's suffering from what it sounded like anyway, veterans related issues, PTSD or whatever. He's got a substance abuse problem. So as opposed to putting blame on anybody, I will wait to find out what the details are. But on the alternative, as I've said before, I found it very difficult to deal with the DA's office on a high level. So if you think you've got veterans problems and you're going to call over there and get a hold of Mark D'Antonio, you're not going to. And I don't even know when he shows up to that office, but if you've got a problem and you're a veteran, it's related to your veteran issues in the court here. The number of my office is 805-1245. Call up. If I can't help you, then I'll find somebody else. I know a lot of attorneys in town, and somebody will be able to at least give you some advice and some direction. Anyway, all right, so let's see here. I want to kind of following up on the story, there is an article that was written, Four Reasons to Rejoice Over the End of Obama's Myth-Based Foreign Policy. I just want to mention these and move on because I know it's kind of a depressing topic. He mismanaged the war, and this is out of the Federalist, which is about the finest online journal. It was published 2 days ago. Four Reasons to Rejoice Over the End of Obama's Myth-Based Foreign Policy by Paul David Miller. He mismanaged the war in Afghanistan. And two, his approach to stability operations was strategically incoherent. I'm not going to get into these. There's other stuff I want to get into today. But three, he contributed to the collapse of Iraq and the rise of ISIS. That is undeniable. And hold on. Four, he declared mission accomplished. Pulling a George Bush there. We've got a phone call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connor Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Tom again. I'm just going to say goodbye to Obama. He started out his presidency by going around the world and apologizing for our exceptionalism. And he went and said, my son is Trayvon. I remember him being real good friends with the Muslim Brotherhood, inviting them in. He's caused nothing but havoc in this country. And goodbye, Obama.
Goodbye, Obama. And you won't be missed. But remember the first thing he did, he went and he canceled. I guess that's a goodbye from Tom. All right, Tom. You can say goodbye, by the way. So the first thing that Obama did was he canceled the missile shield to Poland. Poland was absolutely astounded. And one of the things that Obama does is, in addition to focusing on low-hanging fruit, which is his real, he goes and does whatever you can do through a presidential decree because he doesn't have the wherewithal, he doesn't have the connections to get things through Congress. But he turned his back on not only on an ally, but and thought that it wouldn't matter, but he canceled a missile shield, which then after the invasion of the Ukraine looks like an absolutely spectacular mistake on his part. And now he's fighting Russia and begging them to this is the weird thing. All right. So Trump is supposed to, I'm just realizing this right now. Trump is supposed to be this guy that is just buddy buddy with Putin, a guy that he says he doesn't really know. He's never really done any business over in Russia. And the media has repeatedly called him Putin's friend and his number one booster. Now, do you recall Obama cancels the missile shield in Poland? What would be the reason to do that? How would it be in America's benefit? I mean, that benefited Russia strategically. So you've got that, and that's totally out of the blue. There was some plan that Obama was working on from day one, whatever it was. Call it globalism for lack of another bigger word, better word. Then when during the re-election period, he goes and he talks to the president of Russia and he says, I can't do anything now, but wait till I get re-elected. I'll have a lot more room. This is on a hot mic. He doesn't know he's being recorded. He is not only friendly with Russia at that point, but he's telling them, I will get you guys what you need. After I get reelected, I'll have a lot more power. So why isn't his name brought up when we're talking about kissing Russia's butt? Because Obama's done it more than anybody else. But, of course, the media, it's the job of the media is not to report and to illuminate. Their job is to hide and obscure. So I just, you know, this idea that Trump is some sort of a master agent for Russia doesn't even pass the sniff test. All right, so shifting gears here, has there ever been a president-elect who has taken over this quickly before? Check it out. They're talking about how Trump has hit the ground running before he's ever gotten into office.
And we're back with our Sunday panel to continue the discussion of what Mr. Trump said in our exclusive interview. George, as you may have noticed, we called this hour the Trump way. Have you ever seen a transition like this one in all your years in Washington where the president-elect seems to be taking over?
Nothing remotely like this. At the Army-Navy game, he said to you, presidency is a daunting responsibility. He looks completely undaunted to me.
I totally agree with that. Let me say, he seems, not that he's unmindful of the responsibility, but he's comfortable assuming the role of president, assuming the role of commander-in-chief.
He is wielding power now. He wielded it in the Carrier case. He still has 40 days to go before he stands at the Capitol and gets sworn in. Just think if we were in the position we were in 1932 when Roosevelt comes in and they still didn't inaugurate a president until March 4th. That caused all kinds of problems because Hoover tried to entangle FDR in his own policies. Mr. Obama's in a very difficult position here because he's sitting there saying that technically I'm president. And Mr. Trump is not impressed by that technicality.
No. And in fact, sometimes you have to remind yourself of that, that Mr. Obama is still president, which brings me to you, Julie Pace. What did they make of this at the White House, the degree to which Mr. Trump is taking over?
I think they do find it unusual to some extent. I think there was some expectation, particularly when they thought it was going to be Clinton who was elected, that Obama would have some more freedom during this last couple of weeks because he would be handing off to someone who presumably would keep whatever he was doing in place. You're not seeing Obama enact a lot of policies. He is doing some small bore measures, some cleanup right now. But I think the most important thing that's happening at the White House right now is what's going on behind the scenes in terms of Obama's conversations with Trump. I am told they are speaking on a somewhat regular basis and that the president-elect is asking very real questions, actually trying to get some guidance from President Obama. And I think the White House sees this as an opportunity to try to preserve some of what's in place right now, try to make their sales pitch to the president-elect before he ends up in the White House.
All right, so enough of that. But it is kind of notable that this has occurred because I've never seen anything like it either. And this, what I would like to see is for defense of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and some economic growth. Once the economy starts growing, so many of the things that we're complaining about go away. So let's just say that the president who's in office right now, his goal was to make the country more leftist, which, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt there. You keep the economy down. You increase the number of people on welfare, Obamacare, Medicare, Medicaid, Section 8, food stamps, TANF, all of these different programs. And the more people get on that, the more they fall in love with it and the more they fall in love with the government and see government as the answer to all their needs. 718, I've got a little analysis on Obamacare that I think you'll find interesting that came out of an article that I read last night in The Atlantic, and it was illuminating. 718 AM Las Cruces, 523-1450. We will be back. And then on the second half hour of the show, we're going to dig into a little bit of Christmas facts. Be right back. And this is Change of Pace here, the Eagles, with the beautiful voice of Don Henley.
Bells will be ringing.
Okay, so 723, here's what Trump voters want instead of Obamacare. This writer, Olga Kazan, went to Pennsylvania, went to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and started interviewing people on why they voted for Trump. And a very common response was Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And the repeated statements, just to boil this article down, as I said, is in the Atlantic Monthly, is that the Affordable Care Act didn't make health care less expensive as it was promised. It made it more expensive, and the deductible went up. So in two different ways, it made it harder to get health care. In addition, the subsidies that were coming from the government didn't really pay off. They didn't really work. And so there's another article that I have. And here, you know, here's one other thing in here that kind of caught me off guard a little bit, was that people repeatedly said, I don't believe in a system in which people are rewarded for being indolent, for not working. So that was a repeated thing. Now, I, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention about leftism, since we're kind of dumping on the president today, leftism is, as I said, an attitude, but the way it is sold, if you think about this, and Ralph just got up and called up and said that he's an expert at vocal recognition and all this stuff. I believe that if you boil down the appeal of socialism, a lot of it would come out of the tone in which it's delivered in, an ironic tone, to a presentation of socialism, and then anything that's not socialism is treated with skepticism and treated as a comedy and as just a complete joke. And I think that's people, you know, they talk about nonverbal communication, but there's a part of verbal communication that is, has to do with the presentation, the tone, the juxtaposition of how people talk about things between one and another. And if you were to strip away this, and this is typically what you pick up in the media or for people in Hollywood, you pick it up from this, the class of people that you would call elites, the most wealthiest people are tend to be liberal. Hollywood actors, stars, liberal. The educated class, or the you know, the university professors, and then of course the news media are all liberal people, and what they present these ideas as if just to talk about them, socialism is holy. And just to talk about conservative ideas is evil. And so you never really get into any proof. There's never any real arguments. There's never really any polemical interaction, a real debate, because these things are presented to people in a way where they sound credible, where they sound like just the way that, just the tone of the speaker. And, obviously, that's very harmful to America, too, because it gets people into the habit of being lazy. The cool thing is socialism. The stupid thing is conservatism. Instead of getting into the ideas and seeing how they've been applied in history and whether they worked or not, it's this, it is kind of a cult of tone, if you want to put it that way. And I'll have to think about a better way to explain it if that is not kind of hitting home. But the people were saying, you know, we expected one thing from Obamacare and we got another, and the whole undertaking is a complete hoax. And so person after person was interviewed, and I thought it was interesting that they kind of put this across in a way that made sense out of what was going on, because we have been through years in which you had to talk about Obamacare a certain way because it was so beautiful. The idea was so just and perfect. And any criticism of it was ridiculous. You need to go get your head examined if you criticize Obamacare. Now everybody suddenly coalesces and says it's a terrible failure and there's really nothing we can do. Interestingly enough, Obamacare is set for another 30% spike in costs. And this is from investors.com. this is just more, this is flowers on the grave at this point. But not fake news from investors.com. Obamacare subsidy will costs will jump 30% next year. So have you ever seen something that was more overly touted? And then remember, Nancy Pelosi gets up and says, pass it and we'll find what's in it. You know, that's like going to a foreign country. What's in this food here? Well, eat it. You'll find out what's in it. I mean, is anybody going to do that? So spiraling subsidies on top of news that Obamacare's medical expansion is costing far more than expected per enrollee, 49% more to be exact, 50% in other words, comes from that figure comes from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. Have you ever seen a worse? I mean, remember when it was rolled out and the website wouldn't go up for hours? And just everything about this, you know, the rush to get it passed, the lies, the tsunami of lies that the president and his minions came with, and every single thing that was promised is not going to be able to come true. It's the opposite. It doesn't cost less money. It costs more. It's not easier to get coverage. It's harder. There's not more options. There's less options. And yeah, so anyway, that is what has happened in a nutshell to the president's plans. Now, coming back, take a break. We'll come back and talk a little bit about Jesus since it's his time of year. I've got a clip on, I can only find one relatively short clip, but it's on the number of prophecies that were laid out there in the Old Testament. Interesting stuff, 7:30, even for a Frankie who says the very idea of God is a joke. Talk about communication by attitude. 7:31, we'll be back. Choirs will be singing, silent night, Christmas carol, back in the light. Please come home for Christmas. Please come home for Christmas. If not for Christmas, by New Year's night. All right, so I think this clip is going to be good, but I think tomorrow I've got a little clip on they found some pottery shards that had been written up from the time when the Jews were in the Babylonian exile and what their life was like there. What I find interesting is that from a group, according to the text anyway, from a group of people that were living in this pagan area, many years afterwards, hundreds, thousands of years afterwards, there was a group of men who came that were apparently stargazers. And then these three kings from the song had come and had been led by the star. Now what's interesting about that is that the person who was put as the head of the soothsayers in Babylon was Daniel. And I'll tell that story tomorrow, but it's kind of interesting. He must have left a legacy. If the story is true, he must have left a legacy, including the heavenly bodies and what they foretold. So very interesting stuff from history and from science as well. But here is the 300 prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. This is the name of the clip, anyway.
When it comes to the prophecies of Jesus, one of the most remarkable things is what takes place when you take those prophecies of Jesus and you work them out mathematically. Now, there has been a mathematician who's done that. Peter Stoner, famous mathematician, went in, looked at how many prophecies there were, 300 prophecies. And then as he broke down those prophecies, he said, let me just take eight of them and figure out what's the likelihood of eight of these prophecies being fulfilled in one person's life.
So Professor Stoner gives us an illustration. It helps us to understand the nature of probability. So let's just say that one in every 10 men that you meet has a bald head. And one in every 100 men that you meet happen to have a missing finger. You want to find out how many men are there that I'm going to bump into that actually have a missing finger and a bald head. So what you do is you multiply the first two figures, and then you have your answer. One in every 1,000 men that you meet are going to actually have a missing finger and a bald head.
Peter Stoner presented his class with a challenge. The class was to look at the Bible and try to find all the prophecies regarding the coming of Christ to see what was the probability that one man could come out of all the men that existed in the history of the world and yet fulfill exactly every single prophecy.
One of the prophecies that Peter W. Stoner mentions is Zechariah 9:9, which reads, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." The question is how many people in Earth's history have been kings? And of those individuals, how many have ridden on a donkey into Jerusalem?
Well, I don't know. Neither did the class. So they decided to assign an absurdly high number. They decided one out of every 100 men who ever lived rode into Jerusalem as a king on a donkey of all things. I mean, one in 100. This is obviously absurdly high, but that's the point. Stoner effectively buffered his calculations and thus his conclusions against objections that he had biased his calculations to favor Jesus' identification as the Messiah.
Another prophecy that Professor Stoner looked at was Micah chapter 5 and verse 2.
In Micah 5 verse 2, there's an incredible prophecy that is given hundreds of years before the birth of Christ, pinpointing exactly the place where Jesus would be born. It states, "But you, Bethlehem Ephratah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel."
What's amazing is the fact that there are two Bethlehems, two cities called Bethlehem in Israel, one in the northern portion of the kingdom, one in the south.
This specifies which Bethlehem? This specifies Bethlehem Ephratah, which is Bethlehem in Judah. So the prophecy is very precise. But in addition to that, when you think about Mary and Joseph, Mary finds out that she's pregnant. She's in Nazareth. And yet suddenly this decree comes out. This census is being proclaimed by the Romans. And they're told that they have to go back to the birthplace of the husband. And so Joseph makes his way to Bethlehem in Ephratah.
They have to take their family back to Bethlehem. Joseph has to be taxed. According to Roman law, Jesus is born in Bethlehem.
The prophecy fulfilled right to the very, very place where Micah, hundreds of years earlier, predicted it to happen was just remarkable when you think about all the circumstances involved.
So Stoner and his students, they decided that they wanted to figure out, in the light of the world's population, how many people have actually been born in the city of Bethlehem. One out of every 280,000 people was a very conservative estimate that they made, that they found mathematically, of how many people have actually been born in Bethlehem.
Now, another prophecy they looked at is found in the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth."
Stoner brings this out, that Jesus was a just man, condemned to die, and he said not a word, not one word in his defense.
Now, how many have done that? Well, his class didn't know. Of course not. How could you know? So here again, they assigned a conservatively high number. For the purposes of their calculations, they said, okay, how about one in every 1,000 men who ever lived were both wrongly accused of a crime and during their trial chose to speak no word in their defense.
And then as he broke down those prophecies, he said, let me just take 8 of them and figure out what's the likelihood of 8 of these prophecies being fulfilled in one person's life. So just with those 8 prophecies, he said the probability of one person fulfilling all 8 was 1 in 10 to the power of 17. That's like taking silver dollars all over Texas.
They covered the entire state. And on one of those coins, somewhere in the state, you have a particular coin marked with a black X.
And you put it randomly, stir it up somehow, and randomly put it somewhere in the state of Texas, covered 2 feet deep with these silver dollars, and you send a blind man in. The probability that he will just wander the state of Texas, reach down on his first try, and come up with this marked silver dollar is the probability that one man could fulfill all eight of these prophecies about Jesus. Now, not only that, but it actually, he went further and he said, all right, let me see if I take 48 of these, 48 out of the 300. Okay, what's the probability that one man in the history of the world could fulfill just 48 of these prophecies? And the number was a staggering one man out of one with 157 zeros after it. That number is so big, just to give you an idea. Scientists have determined that there are only one with 80 zeros after it, atoms, in the entire universe. That's not just our planet or our solar system or our galaxy, but the entire universe only has one with 80 zeros after it. There's not even enough atoms in the universe in order to hold that number. Now, this answers the question about some people say, well, you know, maybe a lot of people have met these prophecies. Maybe it's not just, Jesus, that you could have a whole bunch of people who meet all of these prophecies. But that's just not possible. It's so mind-boggling. It's so impossible. And that's not even close to the probability of what it would be to fulfill 48, which is one with 157 zeros after it. Staggering. Staggering. That's only 48 prophecies. There are 300. What you've got in here is you've got something so remarkable that the whole universe can't hold it. In fact, this is what Peter Stoner said. He said, any man who rejects Christ as the Son of God is rejecting a fact proved perhaps more absolutely than any other fact in the world.
Interesting. Just briefly, you know, the Jews rejected Jesus. That's obviously one of the most well-attested facts in history. There was another guy that came along. His name was Simon Bar Kokhba. When you look at the history of Israel, when Jesus was crucified, Israel didn't, you know, completely crumble to dust at that moment. But by the year, I think it was 132 AD, the state of, or the country of Israel, which had been under Roman subjugation, was totally dismantled. And the Jews were driven out of Israel. Now, what led to that was the revolt called the Bar Kokhba revolt. It's in 132 CE now, or AD. Interesting, and I didn't know anything about it. I ordered a couple of books on it. What I found out was so interesting. I'm going to hold this off till tomorrow and tell you about it. It is one of the most extraordinary stories and is so unlikely, but it led to the following after Bar Kokhba, Simon Bar Kokhba, led to the demise of Israel as a state. 746 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450, and I've got some local weather for you coming up right now. Okay, I have another story out of antiquity, a recent discovery, and this is according to Hartz, or Haaretz, H-A-A-R-E-T-Z, and divers uncover the world's oldest harbor in the Red Sea. So I'll tell you about that in a second. We have a phone call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Hey, Kelly, this is David. How are you?
David, how's it going, man? I'm well. What's on your mind?
Anyway,
you too.
But anyway, for Frankie out there, his Messiah is leaving office on January 20th, and his Virgin Mary did not get elected to office. So I'm hoping that he'll at least have a Happy New Year.
I agree 100%. I'm for once left without words, thinking of Hillary as the Virgin Mary is about as far a stretch as you can get.
That's the way they think, though.
Yeah.
I'm just putting it in the way they think, not that she what she really is, but the way her followers think of her.
Yeah, she is presented as this mythic uber woman, the mother of all mothers, you know, really the mother of all disease. But anyway,
the mother that couldn't crack the glass ceiling.
Yeah, although her looks could have cracked it, if she, you know, but. All right, David. Anything else?
No, that's it. Happy Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas to you too. Thanks. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connor Show. Who's this?
Oh, good morning, Kelly. This is Steve.
Steve. Yeah, nice to hear from you. It's been a little while. Merry Christmas to you, and I hope you're well. And what's on your mind?
I got an early Christmas gift this year. It's all coal. I'm calling to help you prepare you and our listeners, my far-off friends, that what's coming down the pipeline now is going to be this general collective accusation that Trump is a fascist.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's here, and it's going to start spreading, and people are going to start developing that idea. And that's what I think you got to prepare yourself for. Maybe a discussion about.
Yeah. Well,
some of the overlapping.
Yeah. All right.
Because that's the accusation.
Yes.
So, prepare yourself, my friend.
I am already prepared for this. Maybe not emotionally, but intellectually. I
know.
Yeah.
Emotionally, it tears me up too. It's really disgraceful the way the left is.
Far leftism.
Since the election.
Far leftism has always operated through smoke and mirrors, through the discrediting of opponents, through every, you know, there's a huge difference between far leftism and just being a Democrat or a everyday liberal, you know?
Yeah, it's real lack of intellectual dishonesty. I used to beg my friends, yes, you got to be honest, you got to say that. But they don't want to admit it to themselves and each other, or especially the public. But anyway, you don't lose the faith. You had a great year. Hope you have a great next one, okay?
You too, Steve. Thanks for the call. Merry Christmas.
YouTube.
Thanks. All right, folks. Now I've got to take a break. I may not be able to get to this point, but the main thing is, I can always do it tomorrow. But this harbor, world's oldest man-made harbor. Be right back. 7:52. Okay, so divers uncovered world's oldest harbor in Red Sea. Archaeologists find monumental harbor built by King Cheops, you know, the same guy that did the Great Pyramid, 4,600 years ago at Wadi El Jarf to import stuffs to build the Great Pyramid of Giza. And interestingly enough, so this thing is located, if you're wondering, up the Gulf of Suez. So it would be to the... it would be in the direction of the Gulf of Suez, in the direction of and connected to, surrounded by Egypt, and then it's the Red Sea behind it. So where Moses supposedly opened the waters, parted the waters. All right, so. It was built 4,600 years ago, and Cheops, also known by his Egyptian name of Khufu, sounds like a rapper, reigned from 2580 to 2550 BCE. He had the harbor erected south of Suez in the foothills of desert mountains. Now, even at low tide, you can still see it. And so they have found not only the world's oldest man-made harbor, but they also had and the Romans did the same thing. They built a man-made port, a man-made harbor that they named Portus. But anyway, King Cheops was not just a great pyramid builder. He's also a great businessman. And he built the harbor to secure a supply of strategic resources such as copper and turquoise. And Egypt's history was tied into boats and boating. Some of the astounding discoveries there beneath the waves at Wadi El Jarf was a monumental 200-meter-long L-shaped pier built of large limestone blocks. The pier also functioned as a breakwater, offering sheltered anchorage for boats moored within. And the diving archaeologists discovered 22 limestone ship anchors in situ, in place in the mooring area, which probably fell off ships, and no shipwrecks have been found. Several large storage jars lying on the seabed next to the anchors were also found underwater, and they have found there the world's oldest papyrus as well, which described the creation of this harbor. And so it's pretty exciting. What they're calling an impressive level of organization for 5,000 years ago, and maybe even a factory for boats there. And perhaps the most astounding was the discovering in summer of around 800 pieces of papyri dating to the reign of Cheops' 27th regnal reign, 27th year in office. This is the oldest papyrus archive ever found in Egypt, and had the possibility of a pyramid inspector as part of it. So fascinating stuff. Haaretz, HAARETZ.com. Just look that up. Thanks for tuning in. It has been wonderful to spend time with you today, as always. Kelly O'Connelly and Las Cruces on KOBE, and we'll take you out with some Eagles. Please come home for Christmas. Ciao. See you in 22 hours.
The time of year to be with the one you love. So won't you tell me you'll never more know Christmas and New Year will find you home. There'll be no more sorrow, no grief and pain. And I'll be happy, happy once again.